Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, Ilona Thompson here with Palate Exposure. I'm here with John Hofliger, who is a founding partner and a winemaker at Alpha Omega, a brand that experienced meteoric rise. What it seemed like, it went from obscurity to complete and utter adulation by trade, press, and of course consumers. So we're here to get to know John, and he's gonna tell us all about who he is, what makes him tick, what's important to him, where he came from. We're gonna get to the bottom of it. So the first question is, tell us about John.
Well, that's a broad question that I'm not sure I can answer ever. Because in order to answer that question, you'd have to understand yourself, which is always a little bit difficult. But I can tell you, I was born and raised in Switzerland.
Where?
In Lausanne, Switzerland, okay. The French-speaking part, by an American mother and a Swiss dad.
Huh.
Grew up there, and every single male in the family on both sides of the ocean were attorneys. And so I decided to follow the same path and ended up in law school. The first 2 months of law school summarizes really well the rest of the 2 years. Show up at the cafeteria at 7:30, grab a coffee, start playing cards, decide to skip class, play cards until 10:30, 11, then look at your friends and say, okay, let's go have a bottle of wine somewhere, I'll cook you lunch. And so go to a house, open a bottle of wine, keep on playing cards and eating food, and at the end of the day, playing cards and drinking wine, we say, okay, see you tomorrow at the cafeteria. And that that same exact profile repeated itself for a long time, and at that point, I kind of understood that law school was just not my cup of tea, and decided to do something else. So I went to wealth management. Being in Switzerland, it makes a lot of sense. And the same theme came back, the same love for wine, for discovering, visiting different areas and tasting. And so what I ended up doing is saying, okay, I get the message, let's do the wine industry. And so I went into the wine industry and asked my godfather at the time to be able to work in his cellar, in his winery, to see if it was really what the direction I wanted to take. And and the first day the winemaker asked me what I wanted to do, and I looked at him and said, well, you're the boss, so you have to tell me. And he looked at me and says, okay, let's taste wine. He said, okay, with pleasure. And so he said, okay, let's taste everything that we have in tank and different lots. And we tasted 62 different lots. I remember, and I will never forget this number, because at that time I didn't realize you were supposed to spit. And so after 62 wines, I felt fairly happy and loving my life, and went home and decided never to get away from that industry. As you can imagine, today I learned to spit because I taste an average of 40 wines per day, averaged out over the year for 7 days a week. So thank God I know how to spit. But that's how it all started.
So Jean strikes me, and that's multiple years of tasting his wines, as a very cerebral, very self-aware winemaker. So it makes sense that his background would include parents that were clearly intellectuals. And the fact that you made this very deliberate and very learned choice to go with your gut. Where did that come from? I want to know why the switch was thrown when you said, this is my thing, this is something I want to pursue.
Because I think that wine is an amazing balance between guts, heart, and instinct, and science, and knowledge. And when you think about it, science is actually the worst enemy of art, because it's a tool for standardization. And if you standardize any subject, any form of an expression, you turn it into manufacturing and not art. So in the wine world, you have to know and understand the scientific part. You have to control it and know how to use it, or at least to have it as one of the tools to make your wine. But all your decisions have to be based on your gut instinct and your heart. And the more you make wine, the more that experience becomes bigger, and the more your guts and your instinct are going to be right, and you use science purely and solely for research or for confirmation of your decisions.
So I can feel or surmise he's blowing up in UCDs right now, because what's happening is you're describing a process that's highly intuitive. In addition to your skill set as a winemaker, your value judgment is really rooted in what it means to make something that's more than just fermented grape juice. It means something, the gravitas comes from your artistic point of view as a winemaker. Is that correct?
That is correct. I think wine has multiple facets, one of which is a tool that society has, especially today, to bring people together, to unify people, to have people humanly, physically interact in an era of dramatically fast pace, work, life, and movement. And I think wine just is one of the tools that society has to slow everything down so people can enjoy it. The other part of wine is it's an undiscovered, ununderstood product where only part of the equation is actually analyzed and researched and controlled. I'm not talking only, of course, about the climatic expression that every vintage shows, but also how certain molecular evolve in certain years and in certain condition more than others, and the interaction of one of these moleculars with others and how it is beneficial to your palate. So when a product is judged by the consumers with their nose and their palate, I think it only makes sense to make it based on a nose and a palate.
Well, the sensory evaluation, I think, yes, integral to the wine industry. There's that emotional aspect. And we're going to dive deep into it. But first, I want to tell people that don't know who you are, back to the early beginnings. You're European. You're correct. Of the old world, Switzerland. Take me back and tell me how it all began. How did you even come to the United States?
Well, so when I decided to make wine, started in Switzerland, after a certain time in the cellar, somebody, my godfather, came in and says, "I found your job. Either you take it or you're fired." And I looked at him, and I like conflict, and I thrive on it. So I said, "Okay, I'm fired. Goodbye." And after 2-3 days, I went back to him and said, "Okay, so what is that proposal? Now we can talk." And he looked at me and says, "Well, I found your job in California, in Dry Creek, and at Michel Schlumberger at the time." And I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to try and go see it and seek it out." So I went there and did a year in the cellar and then 6 months in marketing and sales to know right away both sides of the business.
It's quite unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I loved the time. That was 93, 94, mm-hmm. and 94, 95. And already at that time, I kind of saw an amazingly competitive wine business where you had to queue to be able to have the opportunity to pour to store your wine to see if they would like to buy a few bottles or not. From there, I went to Hartford Court, Hartford Family, and became the cellar master during 97. I think it was for the night shift, and it was really cool because it was a time at Hartford where we had Dan Goldfield, Bob Cabral, Ludovic Dervin from Mom, all working together as one. And at the time, I learned a lot from these guys, and it was really an amazing experience working on Pinots more than up in Dry Creek, where I was making cabs, of course. And then from there, I went to South Africa, to Mierlust, to Chateau Carbonnier as well, in Bordeaux. And in Chateau Carbonnier, a bunch of different things happened. One is the winemaker, that winemaker, asked me to go to his house for dinner, and blind tasted me on a wine, and blind tasting is really interesting, but it's a very difficult exercise where, just like the lottery, sometimes you can win, and that day was my day.
That's a great analogy.
And I won, and I think I impressed him, and so he gave me a lot of responsibility early on, managing the winemaking for red and white and one of their other chateaus called Chateau Les Arcs, and helping him on the wines at Chateau Carbonnier at the same time. That was the first amazing moment. And then the second with him was when I asked him, "What do you think I should do? Should I go to school, be a self-made winemaker? How do you think that should work?" And he told me, "I think you should go back to school and you should get that safety net of having the diploma and the theoretical part of this job. And so I said, okay, and I followed his advice, went back to Switzerland, completed all the degrees that you need, and honestly, that for the most part you don't use, especially if you follow your guts and instinct. And I think that the wines that I make today have nothing to do with what I was taught in school. And then from there, and after school, I went back to Bordeaux to work at Lynchbach, and got really tired of the Bordeaux aristocracy and kind of static society at the time, and wanted to come back to that dynamic entrepreneurial California. And so I applied to a bunch of different wineries and became a winemaker at Newton, where I stayed from 01 to 05. And in 05, Robin Baggett came and asked me to start off Omega, and in 2006, you know, that's what we did. And here we are today, about, you know, 13 years later, 14 years later.
I love that you, some of the foundational mentorship things happen in Sonoma.
You're not
a winemaker now, but you actually started in the other valley.
Yeah, in very different varietals as well, when you think about it. I was born and raised on Chasselas and Pinot. I'm making now mostly cabs and chards. I make a lot of Pinots down at Tolosa as well now, but really kind of that Pinot influence, that Sonoma influence, that colder climate influence, you know, that transition really into where I'm at today in Napa is a huge way of, I think, of describing the personalities of wines that I make today, which are usually with a higher acidity and tannin content. Because I believe that the tannins are the skeleton of the wine and the acidity, the backbone. And the bigger a wine is and the warmer, therefore, a climate is, the more you need a backbone and a skeleton to hold the wine together.
And there's certainly a level of transparency to Pinot Noir, for one, that you cannot mask. You either do it right or you don't do it at all. And you learned early that must be the case.
Yeah, I think Pinot Noir for me is probably the most difficult red varietal to make because it allows, you know, pretty much no mistakes. Mm-hmm. Except, of course, if you want the Pinot Noir to taste like a Syrah, which is not true to its personality.
Right.
And when you think about it, I think that Pinot Noir has the delicate, sensitive, soft side of a fragile child. And just like children, if you raise them well in the right direction with structure and precision, they blossom into some very complex, smart individuals in life. And Pinot is... it's kind of the same way. You have to follow it extremely closely. It goes in different swings, but if you're there for it and show it enough love, it usually turns out to be some of the most exceptional wines in the world.
I find that varietal to be very intimate.
Yes, intimacy is of it, because you're much closer to the soul.
Yeah.
You cannot cover the soul of Pinot with a lot of wood or other things, right? A lot of makeup. It's fairly straightforward. Yeah, that's a good analogy for sure.
Thank you. So there you were at Newton, which is an iconic brand. You were doing very well. Your career was blossoming. You met Robin and Michelle. And there's something that was so compelling about that relationship that caused you to change course.
Well, yeah, you know, they came and they showed me the property, you know, in Rutherford on Highway 29. And at the time it was a dump. I nicknamed it the dump. They had no AC. It had no cooling system on the tanks and absolutely no ways to perform anything, you know, as far as high-end winemaking. And because of that, I've decided to decline their invitation to start with.
And that makes a lot of sense, by the way, because this property was known to be a bit cursed.
Yes. Yeah, a lot of the valley felt that this winery was cursed despite that amazing location. And so I declined, and they came back and said, well, we'll make you a partner, and we'll let you run the show. Mm-hmm. And for 10 years, I actually ran the production and the business side, which is very important in the wine world, to be able to shoot in one direction. And I think that it shows a consistent brand. It shows a more powerful message. And because of that, and because of Robin's vision of direct-to-consumer, we were able to explain literally to the market and to the consumer why we were different in what we were doing. And I think that helped a lot in establishing the brand. The other thing that I have to say that was, for me, completely unique and never seen before is the fact that Robin really had the full confidence. He never interacted with winemaking. He left me completely alone. and never wanted to ask or do any for me to do anything but just let me be and say, Jean, you can be and do whatever you want. As far as winemaking is concerned, I will let you serve that.
What was it like in the very early stages when you stepped into very large shoes? You were designing a brand from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you wanted it to succeed, you wanted it to expand. What was it like as a brand builder as well as a winemaker?
A lot of work.
Mm.
A lot of thoughts and a lot of doubts. Mm. People think when they see the glory that everything is beautiful and easy.
Of course.
And nothing in life and in work, as you know, in different fields, is easy. And it's by bruises that you toughen your skins. It's by fall that you learn how to walk. And I think that when you build a brand, you learn as you go. And if you're not passionate, completely dedicated, it doesn't work as well. And so the luxury of it was you can design the DNA that you want with a total freedom. The downside to it was it requires an enormous amount of work, energy, and time to be able to do so.
Absolutely. One of the upsides was that you were not tethered to a single vineyard. You weren't just making estate wines. You had, you designed the cellar and the working winery in your vision, and then you were collecting fruit from people that you found compelling.
Yeah, I think the beauty of Napa Valley is of two. You know, first is this diversity of soil, because in a region that represents less than 5% of Californian wine industry, wine production, you're having roughly 132 soil variation, which is a tremendous wealth of diversity. That was one. And second is consistency of climate. And when you have these two put together, I think it is really key for a wine to be able to use that diversity just like spices in a kitchen. And if you have a rack of spices that is unlimited, you have to use it when you cook a meal in a dish. And because of that, I kind of started sourcing, contracting, finding blocks, vineyards, soils, microclimate that would represent diversity. And then it's all about making them and respecting their origin and blending them in the right place at the right percentages.
I find it highly instructive that someone of European origin that clearly have been exposed, I'm sure by now, to just about every iteration of illustrious European wines. You have a lot of love for Napa, and it's extremely deep and genuine. I've gotten to know it myself, and I want the listeners to really understand just how impactful Napa is on Jean.
Because I think it's definitely one of the greatest wine-producing regions in the world, with wines of a quality that is unmatched in a lot of the rest of the face of the planet. And when you have such a tremendous potential, you have to not only use it, respect it, but promote it. And today Napa is known in the US. Now it's about putting Napa on the worldwide map at a big, much bigger, greater place. And I think that Napa is known in the US, and the Europeans have looked at Napa from the back of their eyes for many, many years, and they're starting finally to understand its true, real potential, and that's why they're investing so much money these days. I also think that any wine-producing region is based on legacy, and legacy is only built through time. And in the wine industry, time is ageability. And so we have to be able to produce wine that go through time, through age. And therefore, the only way we're going to establish Napa in the world is to be able to create wine that have that aging potential to go through decades and decades and decades of aging. And we lost, a decade or two, trying to make wine in Napa that were very consumer-friendly, lush, sexy, with no soul. And I think some producers wanted to follow trends and movement when it's not always the right decision for the legacy. And I think that the people that are true to their beliefs and true to their roots and philosophy will succeed, because we will be able to show the world at that time how well Napa wines age.
I think by now the listeners are getting a sense that everything you do is deliberate and purposeful. So in that sense, when you choose your vineyard sources, viticulture has to take center stage. But what other deciding factors are there for you to choose a vineyard that you want to brand?
Well, first, consistency. I think in order to learn a vineyard, it is like learning a human. It's growing a relationship. And there's no relationship without time. So you learn to know a person and understanding a person by putting yourself and your friend in different situations of happiness, of sadness, of stress. Vineyard is the same. You learn truly a vineyard by having vintages. Vintages that are warm, vintages that are cold, vintages that are rainy, vintages that are sunny, and see really how they express themselves. That's one, and probably for me the most important. The second is understanding where the site is and what is its forte, and understanding what you can maximize or what you have to work on. To give you an example, certain sites like Dr. Crane or Las Piedras are warmer sites. These warmer sites fit absolutely perfectly a cooler year. They'll always be ripe, right? Their biggest enemy is actually warmer years that have too much sun, too much heat, and might burn some of the flavors and definitely the acidity. So in this case, it's understanding when to pay special attention and where to guide them with shade cloth, with, of course, yields, canopy management, etc., to be able to mitigate the risk of an extremely hot vintage. On the other side, if you have a high mountain site or, you know, down south, a Mount Veeder site or a Carnero site where it's much cooler, well, of course, the equation is completely different. In a very hot year, you're going to ripen extremely steadily and beautifully that wine. In a cold year, you might have a risk of unripeness. And so you're going to have to exactly do the opposite and try to perform and make that vineyard perform into these different conditions. And you only can do that, again, understanding with experience and understanding the site year after year.
So you just described some of the challenges from the winemaking perspective. What was some of the worst? When did you struggle the most?
I usually struggle the most when I lose soul and belief. And it's rare. Because it's usually not in difficult times that you do. It's when things are too easy. Or if people start thinking that they understand and know wine and just know how to make wine, is usually when they should struggle. If you take 2011, it was a fairly mild, cold year. We ripened the fruit. We made amazing wines. If you take 2017, you know, the fires are just one of the equation of that vintage. But mostly grapes were picked before that anyways. So the real factor of 2017 was the heat spell over Labor Day that completely shut down the plant. And most people started picking when they should wait. Because at that time, the plant shuts down, stops its ripeness. So you have to be patient. So I think I will say it this way. My biggest struggles were never in the wine, but if they were, it was because of doubt. And doubt not of what I was doing in the wine industry, as much as doubting my own ability to perform. Every single year, every vintage, still today, I go through phases at harvest, at picking decisions, at winemaking decisions, at blending decisions later in the process, where I have a few days where I'm like, I really don't know what I'm doing. I'm really an idiot. I have two brain cells. And where you completely doubt yourself and you become, just like a rioter, completely naked. It's really, really disturbing. And I mean it. It's like people think it's easy, but when you truly doubt yourself, you progress. And having these moments where you have absolutely no knowledge and no understanding of who you are and what you do anymore, and you completely doubt yourself, is very challenging.
That level of vulnerability, I think, is highly instructive because I think we all experience that. And in your case, it's so refreshing to hear that because you're so revered by trade and consumers alike and clearly wine critics. So you're almost infallible at this point. You've built a very successful brand. And to hear you say that you go through those moments that really keep you on your toes and make you stand up and just really reevaluate so much.
Well, thanks. I think, you know, it's also surrounding yourself and being able to listen to signs and people. A wine is never made alone. It It's made by nature, by teams, by people, by philosophy, by circumstances, by luck sometimes. And it's a constant way to adapt yourself. It's a constant way to find a situation yourself in a certain situation, certain way, and kind of how you navigate from that. And I honestly, the people that don't doubt don't understand what progression is, because I'd rather hear criticism 15 times than praise. And why? Because criticism gives me a chance to progress. Praise doesn't.
You're so acutely aware of the relational aspect of wine, experiential wine. And you told me over the years how many mentors you had, whether it's, you know, just a camaraderie type of relationship or something that's, you know, deliberate and such. I've been continuously impressed with how humble you have been and how many peers you've cited. Tell me about some of the relationships that were, you know, fundamental to who you are as a winemaker and as a human being.
Well, I think you have to start with your family, always, because that's who fashions you and puts you in. I think I have to thank my parents for giving me the time to seek my path when it was not law school, not wealth management, and to kind of understand that. The second, you have to thank the people that believed in you. My godfather, who took me under his wing for the first experience, Michel Roland later, that helped me learn how to blend and understand wines, Robin and his wonderful trust, but everybody, you doubting and having perspectives and teaching. You have to understand, I think that one of the most beautiful things about wine is that interaction. And why is that interaction so key? Because with every interaction, you learn something. And wine is a catalyst to human interaction. So within a discussion, you hear a different opinion, you hear a perspective, an angle that pushes you to discover an aspect you didn't think about, and therefore make you greater. And so I have to thank ultimately people that are touched by wine. Because even the people that pick up a wine and say, I don't like what you make, and this is why. I remember, I will never forget, 2006, I kissed with Parker, the 2006 era from Alfa Omega. And after the tasting, he's like, yeah, I don't know, didn't taste it that great. You know, it's, I don't know, it didn't really hit the spot. He gave me really good ratings up at Newton. So you can believe or not in press, that's a different story. But you should always take something from a criticism and think about it. So Parker comes out and gives us, I think, 92 or 93, when I was hoping for much more, of course. I have to read his review and understand and work at it and understand what's behind it and how come it did not. That's my job. My job is to create the perfect wine. My perfect wine is not 100 point. My perfect wine is a wine that will be drank by everybody and loved by everybody. So it's completely a dream. But I have to thrive towards that dream. And I think that by creating this conversation, by nurturing these opinions, very often different than yours, you grow.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.